Welcome back to the second event in our immigration seminar series this year. As a reminder, the seminar is being co-sponsored by the IMS program and the sociology program at the Graduate Center. Now, starting today, we're going to begin a new tradition, and that is that we're going to ask our graduate student coordinators to introduce our speaker instead of me. And I would like to introduce to you Hayden Zhu, who is one of the two grad student coordinators for this series. Hayden and Dakota, the other grad student organizer, are the two behind the scene people who make everything happen. So I'm very thankful to them. Hayden is a PhD student in sociology at the Graduate Center. Before I turn it over to Hayden, I just want to briefly mention that the event is also being co-sponsored generously by the CUNY Asian American / Asian Research Institute, by the Hunter College Asian American Studies Program and Center, and by the Advanced Research Collaborative here at the Graduate Center. And finally, last but not least, the Hunter College AANAPISI project, or HCAP for brevity. And we have people from all over CUNY and beyond here with us on this Zoom meeting. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Hayden.
Thanks, Van, for the introduction. And good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hayden, and I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Pavandingra. Before the introduction, I would like to let you know that this seminar is being recorded. And the format of the seminar will be Professor Dingra will present for about 45 minutes, and then we will spend the remaining time for Q&A. And you're welcome to type in your questions in the chat or type stack during the seminar, and I'll keep track of them throughout the talk. So Professor Pavandingra is Professor of American Studies and Faculty Equity and Inclusion Officer at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He has also been a curator and senior advisor at the Smithsonian, and has taught at Tufts University, Oberlin College, and Bucknell University. His research centers on immigration, Asian America, race, gender, class, education, and work. He is the author and co-author of four books. His most recent book, which we will hear about today, is titled Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Education Are Not Enough. It just came out last year by the New York University Press. He has also written other award-winning books, including Life Behind the Lobby, Indian American Motel Owners, and The American Dream, and Managing Multicultural Lives, Asian American Professionals, and The Challenge of Multiple Identities. And he is the co-author of Asian America, Sociological and Interdisciplinary Perspectives. And after I turn it over to Professor Dingra, I will include links to these books in the chat. As an expert on immigration, Asian America, race, education, and entrepreneurship, he has been interviewed by numerous media outlets such as the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post, NPR, just to name a few. He also appears on the Netflix documentary Spelling the Dream. With that, please join me in welcoming Professor Dingra.
Thank you so much. That was Hayden. I really appreciate it. And thank you in particular to Van and to Vivian for this kind invitation. And to all of you for spending some time this afternoon. There's a lot of other things you could be doing. So I really appreciate you visiting with me. I think this is my fourth talk to give to CUNY, which is like a personal bingo card, like award for myself. I really appreciate it. And so without further ado, let me start by saying that as I think about topics around race, education, inequality, I often go to what I believe to be all of our kind of go-to source for insight, and that is Fox News. So let me see if this works. All right, please, Hayden, if you can tell me, you can see this split screenshot?
Yes,
succeed. The yes. Public has to stand up and fight against this myth of bias and say that there are behavioral differences that explain outcomes. If white privilege explained everything, please tell me how 7 out of 8 of the recent National Spelling Bee champions were Indian Americans. If skin color was the scourge of people of color, they would not be able to succeed. In fact, why did they succeed, Tucker? Because they studied their butts off. And that's what inner city kids have to start doing.
Okay, so the 2019, so author and commentator Heather McDonald was referring to the 2019 Scripps National Spelling Bee, which is the last one that's been held. And it had an unprecedented 8 co-champions, all but one of whom were Indian American. And if you know anything about the Spelling Bee in the past 20 years, literally 20 years, you'll know that Indian Americans have come to dominate it, okay? I'm not here to tell you that Heather McDonald is wrong when she says there is no racism, but her choice of Asian Americans' academic achievement as counter to the notions of racism, however misguided, carries a point, because discussions of white privilege within education and beyond have focused almost exclusively on the disfranchisement of Black and Brown youth. And yet the same institution, but that reproduces racial hierarchies relative to African Americans, Latinx students, should be studied for its impact on Asian Americans, including high achieving ones. Doing so sheds light on the contours of white supremacy in unexpected situations. Such an intervention matters for the political left as well. Liberals also have trouble talking about racism in the school system when the topic comes to Asian Americans, in particular, high achieving Asian Americans. So Nicholas Kristof, the a highly respected and New York Times columnist whose work I actually really enjoy reading, wrote a few years ago, some disagree, but I'm pretty sure that one factor in Asian American academic achievement is East Asia's long Confucian emphasis on education. To me, the success of Asian Americans is a tribute to hard work, strong families, and passion for education. So as for many pundits, right, his focus is on why Asian Americans achieve so much, which is a very important topic, and I've written about it. Other people with us today have written about it. But that question alone, right, fits a pattern of positioning Asian Americans as separate from other minorities. So they get removed from conversations on race and racism. So McDonald and Kristof may disagree with the implications of Asian American achievement, but both place Asian Americans as honorary whites. It's not only in public rhetoric that the place of Asian Americans relative to race and racism has been misunderstood. Despite the growing attention to white supremacy within education, and just as a quick side note, sociology of education has really taken a step forward in recent years of actively talking about white supremacy itself, not just racism or racial inequalities. So despite growing attention to this, however, Asian Americans have not been cited within this regard in the school system or many other places. We know that race and racism are baked into the organizational functions of the school against Black and Brown boys and girls, whether that be in dress codes, disciplinary practices, teacher rhetoric, school to prison pipeline, and elsewhere, right? In other words, white supremacy is understood in ways that fit the Black-white model, broadly conceived. So we know that whites are dominant because people of color are subordinated to them. With this framing, Asian Americans rarely enter into the conversation on racism and white supremacy. Again, the focus is on explaining their high achievements. Some studies explain you know, the model minority stereotype and the damage that it does to emotional well-being. And there's been a lot of great work on this. Most recent book is by, you know, Jennifer Lee and Min Zhou. I blanked for a second on this Asian American paradox. All right. So, I mean, really, so outstanding work that pushes the needle. But generally speaking, racial discrimination in schools against Asian Americans has been far less investigated. When we talk about racism, right, it pertains to underprivileged Asian Americans for the most part. So for instance, University of Wisconsin scholar Stacy Lee refers explicitly to white supremacy, but she's talking about refugee Hmong Americans in schools whose treatment is more akin to African American students, according to her argument, right? Very far removed from the so-called model minority that animates much of the other discussions that I'm referring to. Okay. In regards to institutions of schools, we do not ask how the school system attempts to position whites over high achieving Asian Americans as for other minorities. And that's the focus of my talk today, right? The ultimate goal is to kind of shed light on the breadth and depth of white supremacy in the school system. So in this talk, I'm going to focus less on the racism Asian Americans say they encounter, not on the reactions per se. Instead, I attend to the way whites in positions of authority in white-run institutions refer to and treat Asian Americans, that situate them alongside other students of color, despite their very different positionalities. I'll also spend a little bit of time talking about how Asian Americans themselves can be complicit in a white supremacy. So when talking about white supremacy, I'm talking more specifically about what I refer to as white normativity. Because I'm not referring to the active disfranchisement of people of color, the denial of opportunities, or the like. Instead, it is the uplifting of white leaders' practices and attitudes as normal, and the framing of those relative of those who deviate from whites as abnormal, especially when it seems to threaten the well-being of those in charge. When I talk about doing well academically, I mean these students are getting good grades. I'm also adding something else here, which I think is really important for this, what's going on among Asian American education, and that's impacting how teachers and others view Asian Americans. In particular, the growth of extracurricular education. Asian American parents are critiqued when they pursue education beyond the school walls for their kids. The growth of after-school education for young children, like in middle school, elementary school, and below, is a national trend. And I can talk about this for a long time if you're interested. Examples of after-school learning centers include Sylvan Learning Center, Kumon, Mathnasium, Russian School of Math, and many other regional and ethnic types of tutoring companies, okay? These were some of the fastest growing companies even before COVID. They're even targeting three-year-olds, meaning the junior Kumon, with a standard kind of self-reliant discourse. I even saw a child in a diaper at a Kumon center. The growth model of these companies is to open in neighborhoods with well-ranked and well-resourced schools, not in areas where tutoring can actually, you know, seems the most relevant, most necessary. And again, this is going to grow under remote learning, with more and more parents worried about how much education your children are getting under these extreme conditions. Okay, so parents are looking to supplement even more than they were before. And so these companies were some of the fastest growing companies in the country even before remote learning started. The pursuit of hyper-education through these venues of whether it be academic competitions like spelling bees or math competitions, or on these, again, these venues of tutoring companies, is the subject of a book that Hayden kindly referred to, Hyper-Education. In the book, I explain how this version of neoliberalism has significant consequences for education. I explain why parents pursue these topics, how kids feel, and what we can do about it. Today, I will explain how such a commitment to education, rather than understood as part of our kind of education system at large, which it is, and I can explain more about that, is framed by educators as stemming from problematic Asian foreign culture. It becomes a site into anti-Asian racism. So to be clear, my concern is how do Asian Americans experience a white supremacy in schools, even when they perform above whites academically? And how does this fit the historical role of schools relative to students of color? And later I will address some on how Asian Americans promote white supremacy as well. To understand how high achieving Asian Americans encounter this white normativity in schools, I studied educators in affluent districts, mostly in the Boston area. Middle and upper class Asian Americans made up the largest minorities in these schools, and I'm referring specifically to Chinese, Indian, and Korean Americans. Okay. Other educators lived in Colorado, in Florida, Illinois, New Jersey, Texas. From 2014 to 2018, I conducted in-depth interviews and spent time with educators across elementary and middle schools, school principals, and other school administrators. This is in addition to informal yet informative conversations with teachers in academic competitions. I won't spend much time on this, but I'm happy to talk more about the research design later. Most people I interviewed were women in these positions, predominantly white. And I also spent time with Asian American families, white families, children, college admissions officers, a whole host of others, rounding out the book itself. So I'm going to walk through the argument that white supremacy is at play in schools in four parts. First, explaining how anti-Asian sentiment manifests at the individual level, such as in teachers' or administrators' comments. And secondly, at the institutional level. So it can't be, this point cannot be relegated to the attitudes of a few teachers. Third, I will briefly connect this pattern to the historical role of schools, right, towards students of color. And then contrast how schools respond to Asian Americans with how they respond to other marginalized groups. All of that is kind of what my general argument is going to be around how Asian Americans encounter a white normativity, despite, again, surpassing whites in academics in these schools. And again, I'll end by talking about how Asian Americans play their own role, kind of complicit in this process. The first way we see white normativity in schools is in educators' reactions to Asian American students' above average achievement. So as I mentioned, I'm looking at well-ranked schools where Asian Americans make up the largest minority group, well above state averages. And Black and Latinx students make up a smaller percentage than the state average. Such achievements by Asian American students were considered a mixed blessing. While administrators and teachers were happy when any student succeeded, they criticized Asian Americans for succeeding too much, thus creating problems for themselves and white students. Administrators I spoke with singled out Asian Americans as a prime culprit for why anxiety manifested in their schools. So if you know about schools today, you know that stress and anxiety are major issues across the country. However, Rachel, elementary school principal, blamed Asian American academic achievement for causing problems for her other mostly white youth. Quote, I would speculate that probably 3/4 of the students who fall into those Asian American cultural categories are doing something academic beyond the school day. It's a lot. Teachers have observed groups of Asian students who are very capable students who kind of flaunt their academic strengths in front of their classmates. So they make other kids feel bad because they're brighter, more capable, and they do more and they do it faster. Rather than consider the possibility that the schools cannot serve these students to their fullest extent, Asian Americans are deemed too eager and competitive. An ironic twist, a school principal of all people criticizes students for completing schoolwork quickly, right? Going too fast sometimes and seeking extra academics. Mary was the prevention specialist for the entire school district in which Rachel worked. She too worried about Asian American mental health, but she dwelled on the emotional well-being of whites whom she read as victims of Asian American student achievement. Our Asian American community in particular, I have students saying that anything below an A is unacceptable. It impacts all of the students, it sure does. In a couple of years, Asians are expected to be 40 to 50% of the student body. Kids report academic bullying, the idea that if you're not taking AP classes or getting A's in all your classes, you're not worthy or not going to get into good college. When you talk with groups of students and say something like academic bullying, They say, yeah, that's what it feels like. Mary is concerned about students, and I respect her concern, but she then in turn labels Asian Americans aggressive bullies. She speaks of their rising numbers with trepidation more than any other kind of sentiment. Local white residents also critiqued Asian Americans for focusing on education. Asian Americans create an unfair system for other families, according to the parents. And this resonates with other work we know about how parents feel about Asian American students. For instance, Mimi wanted her daughter to grow up and become whatever she wanted. Quote, if you want to be a dog walker in life or whatever, that's fine. Really kind of a laid back attitude towards her children's future. Still, she worried about the increased competition from Asian American families. The reality is we have competition here from Asian countries and, you know, different parts of the world that are stronger in education, competition for colleges, for jobs, for everything. There's a white flight from neighborhoods with too many Asian Americans or other parts of the nation, as well as fissures between whites and Asian Americans about how academically intense their school districts should be. You see this in news reports across the country, where white families are asking for less educational pressures on Asian Americans asking for more. There's a real divide there. There's a real concerns that need to be taken seriously. Educators, though, went beyond criticizing academic progress of Asian Americans. White normativity also manifested through educators' racial stereotyping and active critiques of Asian parents as problems, in contrast to white parents. The educators, again, cared about the well-being of Asian American youth, but they read them as victims of Asian authoritarian tiger parenting. Their criticisms went beyond the opinions of teachers just kept to themselves. In fact, administrators would tell Asian American students in one-on-one conversations that their parents should change. Mary recalled a conversation with a high school student. I had a student who was Indian in my office every day, anxious about going home and facing his father, worried about college. I saw him over 4 years. I saw the toll it took on him. I was on him all the time. I'm not your mother, but I am your mother. He skipped over pieces of his childhood that no child should have to. I have the opportunity to get to know kids. I can tell them messages. They ask, am I nuts? And I say, no, you're not nuts. Everyone else is around here. Okay. What I pick up on, let me go to the next thing. I'll respond. I'll elaborate. Some educators told students their critiques of parents. Others educators went a step further and confronted parents themselves who they thought were too focused on things like college admissions. Another administrator said, I would also say to those parents and say, look, is your child happy? Is your child well-adjusted? Does your child have friends? Does your child have time to play? I mean, as a mother, one of the things I knew from the early stages was that I wanted to make sure my daughters played and played a lot. In both cases, administrators based their judgments of parents not on academic research or proper parenting styles or through an in-depth analysis of what goes on in the home, but based on their impressions as a mother and presumptions around Asian American parenting. What's important here is that these people definitely care about the children. And I'm not suggesting that the children's parents may not parent properly. They definitely could be. But their administrators base their assessments on their own notions of what's a proper parenting and apply that model to others without taking the time to investigate home dynamics. Administrators care about students and felt it was their part of their job to tell students and parents how to act. It is as if white children suffer no problems at home or school, and no one else would either. People parented as white, middle-class, college-educated mothers did. Asian American mothers become another type of improper mothers of color. Importantly, these administrators make these racialized judgments, not separate from their institutional positions within a school system, but as part of that position, right? They're earning their salary through giving commentary to students and their parents. And again, local parents agreed with these essentialized critiques. Sally, a white mother whose child attended a Boston suburban public school, worried greatly about the effects of academic competition on her children. She wanted a relaxed experience for them. Asian Americans, she believed, go to extremes to push their children academically. We do know Asian American parents who are calling the schools and saying, my kid is more advanced than you realize. He should be starting this higher level class this year. And we find out that they got their private tutors over the summer so as to excel in the same class they were then taking in the fall. The schools have too much high stakes testing, overzealous parents, over-programmed families, and an infusion of diverse cultural norms, some of which seemingly places academic excellence as marked by achievement above all else. For Sally, Asian Americans are the opposite of nurturing mothers. They're over-programmed and robotic in their pursuit of education above all else. Their diverse cultural norms are as much to blame for student stress as are school testing regimes, in her opinion. If Asian Americans calm down academically, then everyone would benefit. All the problems seemingly would, almost all of them would go away. At the same time, the academic and other advantages white professional families routinely provide to their children are not considered, nor the intensity that white parents can pursue education even for their young children, as we know from other research. So the second way that white supremacy manifests was through school districts' institutionalized efforts to assimilate Asian Americans into their preferred models of parenting. That is, the criticism of Asian Americans did not just rest at the individual level that I've shown. School districts organized meetings to tell Asian immigrants to change their cultural ways and to assimilate. I attended such an event in spring 2014 in an affluent Boston suburb, where Asian Americans made up about a quarter of the student body. The subject of the event was stress in parenting among Asian American students in the district. According to a school student survey, and anecdotal evidence, Asian Americans were slightly more stressed than most of their white peers. So panels of mental health experts, school officials, and youth spoke for 3 hours to a 300 plus audience members, predominantly Asian American parents. The primary focus was on the anxieties and pressures that Asian American students feel resulting from their parents' authoritarian cultural styles. For instance, a panel of Asian American students were asked to explain how the academic expectations of their parents created stress for them. Therapists explained the dangers of parents pushing kids too hard. Parents were directed to engage their children differently, such as to express love to them and not focus on school grades. Parents were even told how to hold and maneuver their bodies, such as to physically lean towards their kids when speaking to them, to hug their children. The biopolitics aimed to assimilate Asian immigrants into Western models of parenting expressing affection were on full display. During the audience participation section, a white mother went on stage to address the Asian American parents. She pleaded with parents to change their parenting styles, for the academic pressure they were causing their children was then causing anxiety in her own children, despite her and her parents, her and her husband's kind of laid back approach to school. The session made Asian Americans into a therapeutic patient who needed to assimilate or risk hurting those around them. Rarely during the event were Asian immigrant parents' own perspective on these matters considered. Factors that could be motivating parenting beyond a supposed authoritarian culture, such as concerns over racism in their school or a lack of social and cultural capital that could be driving their motivations, were not invited for discussion. The fact that Asian Americans actually rarely parent in supposed authoritarian manner was not brought up. Nor was white families' intense pursuit of athletics for young children as an example of intensive parenting in this district. Instead, so the problem impacting all students was Asian American parenting and culture. Asian Americans then were both present and absent from their own session. Such organizational level critiques happened elsewhere. Rachel, a school principal, also disagreed with Asian Americans' pursuit of enrichment academics. She said, if a family asked me, I would say after-school education doesn't make sense to me. I think that exposing your child to a wide variety of areas to find that passion or talent, and then promoting it rather than advancing academics is in my mind a job of a caring and more grounded parent. But as a white woman, the school principal knew she would get more traction with Asian American parents if another Asian American spoke to them. She brought in a U.S. raised and trained Chinese American psychologist to address school parents. She explained, "A concern about stress was what prompted me to bring in an Asian American psychologist who came and spoke with parents earlier this year. When I talked to her in planning her evening, I said I want to try and help parents think about what their goals are for their children and articulate them, and then move backwards to think about what I'm providing for my children now, something that's going to get them there, and what are the trade-offs? I'm not constantly trying to add and build a resume, but thinking about who they are." Again, the institutional message is that parents need to change and assimilate further into a single vision of childhood, one that white parents endorse. Rather than listen to Asian American parents and assume they have a rational perspective to share, educators rely on racial stereotypes to silence them. According to educators, Asian American parents supposedly fail to think about who their kids are. They're accused of being uncaring and ungrounded. And it's worth noting a point I alluded to earlier, that the pursuit of after-school education is a nationwide trend. It's ingrained in our education system. What gets lost in this rhetoric is how the increased pursuit of after-school academics, so commonly associated with Asian Americans, has been part of our nation's school system for decades. In fact, No Child Left Behind put billions of dollars in the tutoring industry, which supported for-profit companies who've gone on to market to middle and upper class families. What's more, the logic of turning to the private marketplace to advance one's well-being in a competitive environment is so taken for granted that most of us don't even consider it strange. In fact, it's hard to consider not doing it in so many ways, for yourself, for your kids, academically or elsewhere. But this broader context is overlooked and downplayed when focusing on the racialized excesses of Asian Americans. I think it'll help to kind of understand these points, these quotations and observations as fitting a pattern of white normativity, right, when it's put into context of other aspects of the school system. So what I want to talk about now is a history of white supremacy, really briefly, to see the broader pattern of school treatment towards communities of color in relationship to what I just presented. Past treatment of other students of color is not repeated here for Asian Americans, but a comparable logic of white normativity has been taught through the schools. Historically, as part of the nation's settler colonialism, schools have long served as arms of the nation state and aimed to civilize Native Americans, deny their cultures, reform them in the image of Anglos. This happened through an erasure of Native American models of pedagogy, parenting, replaced by lessons of American generosity and Christian ideals. As cultural studies scholar Chandan Reddy argues, the state advances the seeming liberal ideology of personal freedom, but invokes violence in the process. The violence here is cultural. For Asian Americans today, their culture is not actively erased by schools, and I'll get to that in a second. But as in the past, schools think they're doing students a favor by trying to civilize them through institutionally sanctioned models of parenting, as seen in the one-on-one conversations and organized meetings. Similarly, the colonizing efforts by the US and Puerto Rico utilized the school system to teach students how to create proper relationships between men and women, how to engage in hygiene, how to participate in physical education, and more. Asian American parents today are not ridiculed for their hygiene. Well, you can think about coronavirus as maybe creating an exception to that, but putting that aside, they're not ridiculed for their hygiene per se. But they are told how to create proper relationships between them and their children, to allow more time for physical exercise, how to hold their bodies, and so forth. As another historical example, the state would send social workers into the homes of Black families as a form of social control. No forced treatment of Asian Americans is happening here. But again, psychological experts are assigned to them through school-sanctioned meetings in order to change their parenting in the aforementioned forms. We see a related yet distinct form of colonial practice here. colonialism can involve embracing aspects of native culture to govern through hegemony, not simply by eradicating indigenous perspectives. Here today, the assimilation of minorities takes place alongside espousals of multiculturalism by schools. Schools like the ones profiled here celebrate youth international backgrounds with welcoming signs and multiple languages at the front entrance and multicultural fairs. And if you have kids, you've gone to more of these than you possibly want to remember. I can speak for myself saying that's true. Schools are not trying to erase cultures as in years past, but they endorse a benign multiculturalism, one that does not threaten the ways of life of the white majority. Such common celebrations of cultural diversity are considered appropriate for the add to white cultural knowledge without questioning privileges. Such multiculturalism allows for the colonial attitudes towards Asian Americans to proceed unnamed. Asian American culture is not erased, but Asian American parents are called nuts because of their presumed cultural leanings. The disconnect between these multicultural embraces and the active efforts to reframe and re-educate parents into a singular model of parenting is not noted. A final way that schools reveal a white normativity is through their selective responses to differences in student achievement and well-being. Again, I'm trying to place what I explained out there in the what I observed in the schools into a different context to drive home the major point. The fact that schools' treatment of Asian Americans stems from an investment in white supremacy becomes even clearer when juxtaposed to their reactions, the school's reactions to when white students outperform minorities. According to current literature, schools do not chastise white families for their achievements when whites are on top, nor do they worry about academic bullying facing minority youth. There are no community meetings shaming white parents, nor do white middle-class parents try to limit their children's advantages when it comes at the expense of people of color. Instead, parents effectively advocate for assistance from teachers, advocate for entry into particular classes, tutoring, and more. Schools maintain institutionalized white privileges through tracking honors classes, making excuses for student absences, and so on. So in other words, schools do not always seek to protect lower performing students, but this is a far cry from how Asian Americans are framed when they outperform whites. Conversely, when minorities underperform relative to whites, they're told to study harder, and their parents are problematized as unable or unwilling to support them. But white parents are not told this when outperformed by Asian Americans. In other words, the treatment of Asian Americans is not consistent with how all racial inequalities in schools are dealt with, and it further demonstrates a commitment to white normativity. Simply put, whites are considered normal. Asian Americans work too hard, other minorities do not work hard enough. Schools further demonstrate their belief in anti-Asian stereotypes by selectively ignoring their own culpability in student mental health challenges and framing Asian Americans as the problem. For instance, the rise of standardized testing is known to cause student stress. Affluent schools in particular see student stress and anxiety due to standardized testing and school homework policies, with all kinds of parents worried about college entry. Federal policies like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top create more investment by schools, families, and students in testing and measured assessments of performance. Schools can be aware of the stresses of school policies and curriculum, but they downplay them as significant problems relative to Asian American parenting, as I've already shown. And you could assume that schools don't engage in self-blame because they're just not prone to doing that. Who is? Right? So when they lack of self-blame by educators, you could say it has less to do with race, right? And more to do with educators' inherent assumptions that schools do the best they can and that problems just stem from families beyond their control. Yet schools do not always ignore their responsibility in student problems. LGBTQ students are known to suffer from significant mental health challenges in school. For example, Mary, the prevention specialist, shared with me that those student, LGBTQ students experience the most mental health problems in her district based on a needs assessment survey. Yet schools do not blame their families as the main reason why. Instead, schools seek to change the internal cultures to alleviate the problems facing those students, recognizing that schools play a problematic role. The fact that schools are open to self-criticism in this regard, but blame Asian American parents for their problems facing Asian American students further demonstrates their reliance on racial stereotypes in guiding their perceptions. With the remaining minutes I have, I want to move away from talking about how whites engage in Orientalist and colonialist treatment of Asian Americans in support of white supremacy. And I want to turn to Asian Americans themselves. I'm borrowing from Andrea Smith's terminology to say that another pillar of white supremacy is anti-Blackness. My point here is that Asian Americans can be, and actually sometimes are, complicit, maybe even active, in supporting white supremacy in education as they draw from anti-Black ideology in their approach to education. In other words, white supremacy is not about whites, but about a logic that marginalizes people of color. And people of color can be active, right, in that process. So let me say a little bit about this. High-achieving Asian Americans further a model minority notion that other groups should achieve like them through a bootstrap mentality. For instance, a leader of an Indian American national nonprofit that created academic competitions like vocabulary bees, spelling bees, math competitions, serving Indian American youth. He commented on how his nonprofit organization could be a model for student achievement nationally. People have been concerned about education for the past 30 years. We haven't come up with a low-cost model. Increasing pay for teachers hasn't worked. Changing the syllabus hasn't worked. This model works. As fitting neoliberal tenets, according to his logic, individuals presumably can improve themselves, not through investing more in public services or tending to underserved communities, but by taking advantage of competitive opportunities. Do not invest in the public, but instead rely on domestic and personal responsibility, right? The same mindset, the same rhetoric that often gets used to weaponize against African-American and Latinx students. Asian immigrant parents themselves differentiated themselves from African Americans by suggesting even genetic differences in fields of aptitude, which then led the racial groups to seemingly prioritize different pursuits. One Asian American father told me when he was trying to explain differences in educational outcomes, everybody wants to be an athlete, but you can't. You can practice hard, you can do what you want, but if you don't have the genes for it, you're not going to excel, no matter how hard. African Americans have an advantage in sports. That's their gene, right? A frequent binary I heard from parents, Asian American parents, was of African Americans as athletic and Asian Americans as academic. It was natural, in other words, for there to be a racial hierarchy in education with Black students on the bottom. When other parents did not follow the example laid out by Asian Americans, they deserve criticism, according to Asian American parents. When I asked one immigrant parent why Asian Americans seem to participate more in academic competitions than excel in them, disproportionately to their population size, he held out his glass as if drinking an alcoholic beverage and said, because most Americans are busy doing this, as if they're just busy getting drunk, right? In other words, Asian Americans can traffic in notions of anti-Blackness, right, which upholds a white supremacy in education, because that benefits them relative to other groups, right? I can say more about this, but I'm gonna stop here for the sake of time. I'm gonna try to wrap up. To fully understand how white supremacy works, it is necessary to study patterns in addition to when whites dominate over people of color, namely when whites appear not to be on top. Such instances may seem to belie the notion that schools are sites of white privilege, as pundits suggest. Yet studying high-achieving Asian Americans through the lens of white supremacy shows the reach of it. It also opens up a new perspective on Asian Americans in school, which today has been dominated by other concerns. It is resentment around the achievements of many Asian Americans that reveal the white normativity embedded in the school system, not just by individual white families. I want to quickly highlight this, right? We often talk about discrimination or problems as coming from individual parents against students. What I'm trying to show here is that it is part of the educational institution. It is an institutional form, right, of bias. Educators see it as their professional responsibility to change Asian Americans' parenting styles in line with the school's colonial legacy. Their interventions are aimed to help not just Asian American children, but also white children who are unfairly bullied in the schools, right? But as I explained, such concerns for students being outperformed is racially selective. We don't see it when white students are on top. The point has not been to target educators and label them as racist. Instead, it has been to show how embedded white norms are within the schools. Nor is this critique of white privilege by educators meant to take away from the sincerity of their concerns for Asian Americans and other students. Authoritarian parenting, whether done by Asian Americans or others, creates mental health problems. These and other schools have real issues around anxiety and stress. Pushing education or any activity onto children can cause emotional distress. The point here is not to excuse or deny problematic aspects within the school districts, including by Asian American parents. Yet the critiques of the problems have relied on racial stereotypes against Asian Americans rather than an attempt to understand what parents are actually doing and why. Furthermore, the reaction to the problems has rested on white models of parenting that are offered as objective and superior. School districts paternalize Asian Americans by telling them how to stand, look at, and raise their children. Furthermore, the school system consistently rewards white upper middle class families and creates challenges for Asian Americans that it fails to recognize. We need to assist children who find themselves in overly anxious spaces, but we can't do that if we misframe the problem. For their part, Asian American parents invested in hyper-education contribute to educational inequality. I can talk at length about why Asian American parents feel compelled to do this and how their motivations stem partly from their upbringing and racial capitalism, but the result is still one of growing inequities. And Asian Americans themselves traffic in white supremacy when they naturalize groups' differences in education. The point here is that Asian Americans need to dismantle their own anti-Blackness. Otherwise, efforts to push back Orientalism and other pillars of white supremacy will ultimately fail. Nonetheless, Asian Americans remain framed as foreigners and are either praised or attacked as a result, depending on whether their actions appear to benefit or threaten others. Here we see that the criticisms of Asian Americans takes place within the institutions meant to support them. Schools may not be a safe or supportive space, even for those students of color who achieve the most in them. And Asian Americans have their own role to play in addressing this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pavan. It was really fascinating. And I really liked how you show the disentangle the complex role of Asian Americans in white supremacy. So now we will move on to Q&A, and we have about 40 minutes. And the first person that I have on my list is Vivian.
Thank you, Hayden, and thank you, Pavan, for just a really terrific talk. It's an amazing book, and I really enjoyed having the opportunity to read it and to hear you speak about it. I encourage everyone in the audience to get it and to read it. And I also know that Pavan is now a diversity officer at Amherst, and that's got to be a tremendous amount of work. And you're also doing a series of book talks in the next few days, as you said. So kudos to you for moving all the different parts of your work forward. Okay, so I wanted to say that the way I read it was I situated your work in what the late writer and filmmaker and journalist Nora Ephron termed parenting with a capital P, in the sense of how parenting is no longer that kind of nostalgic past. And I think she was really referencing middle-class white parents. I think that was her norm, into this kind of hyper parenting. And I think that one of the key contributions of your book is when you say on page 14, despite hyper-education being read as a culturally foreign practice by teachers and local parents, it's actually in line with current educational norms. And then you really pivot in the book so well to the institutional mechanisms that you find to be at the root of all of this, but that are airbrushed out, including what you call neoliberalism. So my question to you is, what do you think about the role of race? And in asking that question, I want to kind of bring together the different strands of what you put together in the book and then what you just shared for us. Because you reference white supremacy as being kind of grounded in white normative, the white normalcy, right? How whites are normalized as being, whites are framed as being normal, that that's their the experience. But then when you interviewed the Indian American parents and you found that they didn't, and these were mainly middle, upper middle class, you found that they didn't necessarily reference or link their parenting to racial discrimination. Instead, they linked it to the fact that they're immigrant minorities who are highly educated professionals, and that they're compensating for a lack of social and cultural capital. They know they can't give that to their kids. Their kids are at a deficit compared to white middle and upper middle class parents in their communities. And so what do? They privilege this kind of academic parenting because it's what they know, right? So I found that to be fascinating. But then your chapter 7, would you talk about part of that title is the haters. And this is the folks who respond on social media to the fact that South Asian Americans and Asian Americans, generally speaking, are winning all those spelling bees. And the language was kind of harsh. I mean, that language was racist. And so I'm trying to kind of figure out what would you say then? What should our response be to kind of, because this is very, very complicated, right? To push through, to actually change the institutional mechanisms that you're saying cut across different groups, right? This is not about groups. This is about institutional mechanisms. So how can they be brought to the fore, made clear? And then where does the advocacy lie?
Thank you for that question and engagement with the book. And I also wanted to thank you for your, this is embarrassing, but I also want to thank you for the work you've done. I've learned so much from your work and I could have referenced it even more than I did, but I won't dwell on, this is not your opportunity for me to praise you, but I want to just note it. So anyway, get into your questions, which I really appreciate. And you really do a good job of articulating how the parents refer to, you know, what's motivating them. They don't refer to as, you know, responding to concerns over racism as is commonly understood, but then they, instead it's a lack of capital they're trying to compensate for, right, in different ways. And I can expand on that if people are interested. But getting to your point around, but at the same time, right, the students encounter, their children encounter racial pushback in explicit and implicit ways in the schools and social media and elsewhere. And even the parents will say, we're not doing this hyper-education because we're worried about racism. But at the same time, we think our kids need to perform like 130 points higher on the SAT than white students do just to get into college. So they can make that comment about the SAT scores, they can be aware of the hostility on social media, but still say they're not thinking about racism. And that seems like a disconnect, right? The question is why? How can it be the disconnect? I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the way in which we being the general public, talk about and identify racism right, is when, as I was talking about here in this talk, is when groups are put down relative to whites. They're not succeeding relative to a certain group, okay? But if we this immigrant population, have, you know, well-paying jobs, we live in a middle-class, upper-middle-class neighborhood, our kids are performing well in school, right? All of those things don't fall into a racial minority kind of group experience. So therefore, concerns about racism don't apply. Even though race can be active, right? I'm not saying race is deterministic, but it's active, right? That gets downplayed because it doesn't fit the model in which we understand racism to operate. And so, and that, you know, again, it kind of falls into a standard black-white model. I don't mean black-white model literally as if it only pertains to African-Americans, but in terms of, we know race is active when a group is marginalized relative to whites. That's how we commonly think about race. That's been a guiding framework within our discipline and elsewhere for a long time for good reason. But that doesn't adequately capture how race operates. And that's one of the things I'm trying to convey. And so, and for parents, there may, you know, on the one hand, they'll say, again, we're not motivated by concerns over racism. It's lack of capital we're trying to compensate for. But at the same time, our kids are kind of, you know, experiencing these tensions. We have to perform better than others just to get the same kind of respect and opportunities, but not connect those two because of how we commonly frame what racism looks like, what racism is. Thank you.
Does anybody else have a question? Yes, Rebecca.
Hi, Pawan. Thank you so much for this talk. I found it so fascinating. And I research in a very similar vein on upper middle class Asian American families, particularly Muslim Americans. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to the internal diversity within the broader label Asian American, you know, maybe to generational differences, religious differences, national differences. I know definitely from my work that a lot of the problems that they're up against are not only racial, but also the way that Christianness is embedded in whiteness for the Muslim Americans that I study. Obviously, so there's just a lot going on here. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to that.
That's great. And thank you for drawing attention to the diversity and heterogeneity within Asian America. I know that my talk kind of frames it in a very kind of singular way, which I tried to, like, you know, make clear. I didn't mean to, but that it's, you're kind of drawing it out, which I really appreciate. So, you know, we know from lots of work that Asian Americans, you know, are really diverse in terms of ethnicity, in terms of class, in terms of generation, in terms of refugee status, right? You know, all religion and various components. So to your particular question around religiosity and kind of and cultural kind of model, proper cultural kind of parenting or other approaches, right? I probably learned from you more than you learned from me in this regard. It wasn't as if the parents I spoke with referred to, some of them were Christians, some of them were actually very devout Christians, referred to religiosity as a, what kept them from feeling that they were parenting properly. They often invoked religion, even if it wasn't Christianity, as one of their mechanisms for, you know, instilling a proper set of values into their children, a proper upbringing and the like. And some parents would connect the pursuit of hyper-education to religiosity. In fact, it even just happened among Asians. I interviewed a lot of white families who engaged in hyper-education. And so I talked with one mother who had her child in a once a week after school learning center, like a math class that met once a week. And I was asking her why she did this and kind of pushing on her and such. And she said, one of the reasons why I have my child in this after school math class is because my grandparents survived the Holocaust. My parents put me through school through hard work. I want to instill that for my child. So she drew a line between surviving the Holocaust and having her child in a once a week math class. All of that helped create, in her mind, once a week math class was part of a set of cultural attributes we're instilling into our kids to raise them to be proper people. And that has less to do with religiosity, even as she refers to, religious trauma, right, than it does with a sense of morality. Now, religion, of course, informs morality, but they're not equivalent, okay? So it wasn't as if parents were saying, because of my religion, I want to pursue a certain kind of upbringing for my kid, in terms of education, right? But they did infuse morality in education. I speak about that a lot in the book. So I'm trying to get to your question in a roundabout way and saying, religiosity itself didn't play as active as a role, but morality did. And to some degree, those are connected, but in terms of the educational pursuits, parents thought of them, didn't really connect them in an explicit way.
Oh, Margaret, do you want to go next?
Sure. I just wanted to follow up. That was a great talk, Pavan. I just wanted to follow up on what Vivian asked about race, because I think I'm grappling with the same question. When do Asian Americans think something is racist, right? And how do they realize it? So I was wondering, doing well or the model minority myth, would that be racist? Maybe it's only towards different groups, or maybe different ethnic groups, or maybe I'm trying to get your thinking, or maybe it has to do with income. When is the model minority myth considered racist by Asian Americans, and by which group of Asian Americans? So that's just a follow-up to Vivian's, because that's what I'm kind of grappling with. But, there are others. I see other questions in the chat. So I'll leave that to you.
I'll try to give a quick response. But then again, not to try to embarrass everyone I speak to here, but if I'm feeling stuck on this question, I know which book to turn to. Sorry, I had to do that. This is not going to be an exhaustive answer, because there's multiple ways of answering the question, and yours response will be as insightful or more so than mine. But one trend that I see as when Asian Americans consider the model minority myth to be racist or a problem is when it constrains them, not when it uplifts them, right? So when I feel that if I feel like it's accurate in terms of, connects with my sense of my narrative of my family's immigration to this country and my upbringing and my achievement through, hard work. And there's a lot of hard work that goes into any kind of achievement. Then in that kind of, that model minority idea follows me or applies to me, and I live up to it, if you will, then that just feels natural. Like that feels respectful, right? But when the same model minority stereotype paints me as passive or unable to assimilate or unable to be, or socially awkward, sexually undesirable, right? That's when it gets read as racist, as a problem. I guess I'll stop there, but that's my kind of quick answer to that. Hopefully, I don't know if that's helpful, but quick answer to the question.
So, Paula, there are two questions in the chat. I'll just raise it in case you want to respond quickly. One is about kind of the nuanced differences among the different white ethnicities and generations. Whiteness, as is being used in the talk, is often too encompassing. And the second question is gender distinctions that you might observe during your research.
Okay, yeah, both are excellent questions. And I appreciate the fact that I was using whiteness without defining it. I gave much more attention to Asian Americanness, and that's a really good call out. So the different ways of answering the question, one is to say when I'm using the term whiteness, I'm really referring to the logic around that, right, as opposed to white people. I try to make that clear. And I really don't want to get into a long etymology around whiteness as a concept, but we can take it to mean the white normativity, right, to be that certain cultural practices are, especially in localized context, run by local elites, if you will, are taken as standard. And that gets used, I guess a lot to say about this, but I don't know if we have the time to unpack all of it. And that gets supported through institutional practices and assumptions, whether that be through education, the courts, the police, and you name it. So that would be one way of thinking about whiteness. But in terms of white heterogeneity, right, that is obviously very real. And even in terms of my own particular study. So I interviewed a number of white European immigrants from Russia and Eastern Europe, right, who similarly engaged in a kind of hyper-education. In fact, one of the spaces that people, one of these theater companies that's really popular in the Boston area and is a national franchise now, is called Russian School of Math. It's like it's taken off to be its own kind of cult following behind this. I mean, I don't mean that in a negative way, but its own kind of, you know, own commitment to it. So a lot of immigrants, white immigrants, were as committed to this as were Asian immigrants, and they spoke about it in a similar way. That is to say, getting back to that kind of Holocaust example, right, reference, parents, Eastern European immigrants spoke about a commitment to hyper-education as a way of preventing a kind of cultural assimilation into Americanness. And they saw, I could go on about this for a very long time, I'll try to be brief, but they look around their local space, and the local space is professionals, upper middle class families in their neighborhoods. And they say, I don't want my children assimilating into that, right? The exact demographic that so many of us think is completely, that's the kind of assimilation we expect to see among our immigrant populations. You know, we could talk about this for hours, right? But we think about downward assimilation and all the other aspects of contextual assimilation. We always frame families that are in, you know, middle class, upper middle class neighborhoods and areas, they're fine, they feel fine assimilating. They have no problem assimilating because that's not downward assimilation. On the contrary, that actually is downward assimilation, not materially, but morally and culturally, according to these families, okay? And to add to this, they saw not just keeping your religion or attending ethnic spaces or family traditions as helping prevent an assimilation. They saw an after-school math class as part of the cultural set of practices that said, we're families that care about things that most Americans, even those in my professional neighborhood, don't care about. We don't want to assimilate and become like them. And I could talk about this for another 30 minutes to kind of expand on this point, give you more examples, more persuasive. I don't want to take up the whole time on this one thing. I got off at the actual question that was asked. But there is white heterogeneity, and that kind of helps articulate that hopefully really well. And the second question is on gender. Again, a really helpful question. I'll probably be brief here. Gender played out in various ways. It played out, but more so in the white families and in the Asian families. White families, so the Asian families who wanted their kids to go get hyper-educated and really committed to education didn't really talk much about, you know, their different motivations for their daughters and sons. They had a similar motivation, is have to be educated to be competitive, to have an opportunity here. Whereas white parents, US born and raised white parents, had very articulate gendered motivations for why they wanted their sons versus their daughters involved in something like an after-school math class. So really quickly, a lot of mothers I spoke to said they wanted their daughters involved in math because they wanted to prevent a kind of lack of self-esteem and confidence in math that they know, that we all know, middle school and high school girls face, right? And so one mother, we'll appreciate this as an academic audience, referenced Larry Summers and his comment around how women can't be good at the science. I mean, paraphrasing crudely, but women may not be good at the sciences because of some kind of, you know, natural, if you will, difference. She referred to that and said, you know, this idea is out there. I don't want my daughters to grow up not being confident in STEM subjects. So I have them in an after-school math class to prevent that kind of, you know, internalization, to build up such confidence in math. When it comes to middle school and high school, they're not gonna have a dip. Right? There's other gender differences in terms of how boys and girls handle stigma. Vivian was really nice to refer to the stigma people face for academic achievement, even in their schools, even from teachers, but I can also elaborate on if you want, and how boys and girls differ in their responses to that. So the gender differences played out in particular ways in these really helpful nuanced ways.
We have Phil and then Vivian.
Hey, Pavan. It's a wonderful book and it's a great talk. I'm really glad that you're here. I coming in from another meeting, so it's possible you covered this earlier, but I think picking up on one of the things that Van was pushing and some of the things you said, well, just as a footnote, there's a wonderful bit in one of Gary Steingart's novels where a mother is bawling out a child who is not nearly performing well enough, and she calls him, "You're so stupid, you could be like the native born, you're so stupid." Which of course raises another question, and I understand the use of race as the way of thinking of this, and I really like the notion of white normativity as a way of thinking that you were either working too hard or working too not hard enough. It's a question of white norms being there, but I'm not sure white really captures it. And I would say, first of all, because white immigrants have exactly the same reaction, who have no doubts about their whiteness, but they, you know, also feel that downward mobility into the native population is a problem. And secondly, because clearly what you say had such clear echoes in the reaction in the early 20th century to Jewish students, you know, who again, were not ever thinking of themselves as not white, but clearly, and in fact, in some sense, much more ferocious, to the point where the Ivy League didn't have hidden subtle biases and quotas, they had quotas, you know, which they published and told everybody about under the logic that, you know, it's fine to have 15 or 20% of them, but at a certain point, we won't be able to compete with them. And it was also consistent with the idea that these people are not sufficiently athletic, they're not sexually attractive, and the social workers are going to have to teach them how to do that and how to work a little less hard at school and stop being grinds wanting tests. So I think the pattern is pretty embedded in a lot of group dynamics in this country. It was for a very long time. And I think putting it into the whiteness frame elucidates some connections, but actually maybe obscuring others. And finally, I was gonna say on the question of assimilation, the notion that groups tell their kids, do not assimilate. You'll be just as immoral and stupid and useless as the natives. Don't assimilate, and yet take actions that make their assimilation inevitable, mm-hmm. like moving them into predominantly white schools in ritzy suburbs, has been true of every successful assimilation case in American history. You know, right. The myth that, oh, we don't want to assimilate, so we want, I mean, there's nothing new about that. No group ever said, we all want to assimilate. What they said was, we want to live better lives. And assimilation happened, as Richard Alba would say, when they were actually paying attention to other things. And so I'm not sure this is as much a break from a lot of upward mobility stories among immigrants, including white immigrants, as a racialized whiteness framework would necessarily imply.
That's really, I take the point. I wasn't just suggesting that despite their best efforts, their kids actually won't assimilate. And it's a pattern that, you know, Richard and Victor, Richard Nee have well articulated that, you know, assimilation doesn't happen because you're looking for it, right? It happens, you know, despite sometimes your best efforts. And that's true for all kinds of ethnic groups across time periods. So yeah, I'm not just, my point was in that last part was that we typically kind of overlook how families try to, we can kind of imagine that families are less worried about that kind of assimilation because it's not downward assimilation. But in fact, they are very, very worried about that assimilation. They're not going to be very effective in stopping it, but no, they're worried about it as we might, they think of it as a downward assimilation morally, right? It's not just about downward assimilation maturely. To your other point around, is this really about whiteness or is it about, white supremacy is, you know, helps, obscures as much as it elucidates. And I think there's truth to that. I think I like to think that it elucidates more than it obscures, because I think it helps draw attention to patterns that are taken for granted within how institutions function, right? And I think it helps to draw out how race informs how institutions function, even though not all white people, right, given as we're just talking about the European immigrants and everything else, right, fit into that same kind of model of whiteness. So I think there's actually use in drawing it out to help explain institutional norms that get taken for granted and that are, you know, consonant with how other institutional assumptions work, is because they're all kind of one big, you know, apparatus. I think it elucidates that, and the fact that not all whites themselves, right, buy into this model of education or parenting or whatever else, right? Yeah, it adds more context to that. But I don't think that, I think the major point though, I would say, is the one around institutional presuppositions and how they operate, right? So just a quick example around this. When they bring in a Chinese American psychologist to explain to Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans how to parent, well, that Chinese American psychologist is telling parents what she or he or they have learned, right, through a kind of standard academic training that's based on a certain notion of, you know, what's proper parenting. And there's validity to those studies, and there's a lot we know about proper versus improper parenting. But there is an assumption around that that a lot of psychologists are now questioning, but is still taken for granted as, you know, natural, if you will, right? So that doesn't mean that all families of a certain race or demographic fall into that category or buy into that same model of parenting or education or anything else, but that we gain more by naming it as such, and how it plays into certain kinds of institutional trends and the hierarchies within those institutions, then is lost with that kind of bland in the characterization.
I take your point, but I would point out that the idea of social workers and teachers telling parents that your parenting style is the reason your kids are a problem, even when it's a problem either because they're underperforming or overperforming the norm, was very much a part of the European immigrant experience. In fact, it's really that entire social work world cut its teeth on the incorporating of European immigrant experience. So where I find the whiteness frame, while I see the value, where I find the framing of it a little bit problematic is that it sort of assumes that European immigrant experience is fundamentally different. And this is one of those situations where I think the commonalities are very, very striking.
All right, the last thing I'll say in response to this, because I don't want to, this is where I wish I was in person, that way we could follow this up afterwards, is that the ways in which the racialization plays out differs based on groups. So I agree with you, right? To meet you halfway with this, I agree with what you're saying, that it is not, the European immigrants have faced a similar kind of pathologizing, right? In these social working or other models of parenting treatment, okay? But the same kind of logic has been applied, but the way in which it plays out is the racialization of it impacts groups differently. And so in that sense, if nothing else, right, highlighting how it's a racial performance as much as it is a cultural one, I think is useful. Maybe we can agree on that.
So Hayden, is it okay if I go next?
Yes, please.
Okay, thanks. And thanks, Phil, for the great question, by the way. I also wanted to thank Van Tran. I can't remember anything anymore. I hope I, if I didn't, I'm gonna thank him again, just for organizing this and just organizing all these great talks. And also Dakota and Hayden, his wonderful graduate students, just awesome. Okay, so Paul, I want to follow up on Margaret's question and the one that I originally asked you, but I want to be really short because I kind of want to push you a little bit. Because it seems from what you've written so beautifully and the other work that folks have done, in these white middle-class suburban areas, Asian Americans are seen as overly competitive to white students. But as you note, and as we all know, right, in, you know, working class and middle class urban centers like New York City, they're seen as overly competitive in relation to Black and Latino students. So my question is, well, what's up with that? Okay, I mean, how do we make sense of that? Different places, same group, different class backgrounds, but yet somehow they're being racialized in a very, very similar way.
Mm-hmm. So to make sure I understand the question, how do we make sense of the fact that Asian Americans in the spaces in which I'm talking about, right, get racialized in this over hyper-competitive way? And I'm referring to, you know, privileged Asian Americans, and yet underprivileged Asian Americans in a different context are racialized the same way as being too competitive, right? I mean, part of that has to do, I don't have the full answer to this, but I'll say part of it has to do with the fact that when we think about these opportunities as zero-sum games, for my kid to do well, they have to attain a resource that's of limited quantity. There's a scarcity to this. So only so many students who can get into a certain honors class, only so many students who are going to be able to get into a certain college, of a certain, you know, whatever level of college we're looking for. It's a competitive atmosphere. In fact, it's built up in that kind of way. So it's going to be, I think, almost by definition, that students who are seen as taking spots that quote unquote belong to me are going to be read as overly competitive. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that as Asian Americans, or many of them are immigrants, or if not, they're read as immigrants. And by that, I mean read as foreigners. Their claim on certain opportunities may seem less secure, less entitled to them, right? As opposed to those who are thought to be, you know, inherently part of a neighborhood, part of a space, and therefore have more rights to whatever scarcity of resources that we're talking about. So it's the intersection of a scarcity of resources along with how certain groups get framed as undeserving of those resources, given their presumed foreignness. That's one way of answering the question. And I'll add on to that, I mean, we know this from other work, including Jennifer Lee and Minjo's work, that, you know, a lot of working class Asian Americans also try to take advantage of after school opportunities, right? And that's not unique to particular class background. And if that, again, if that gets read as somehow illegitimate, as improper parenting, you're not letting your kids play, you're gaming the system, right? And then somehow, again, that gets read as part of a notion of being tiger parents, kind of, you know, overly programmed, all the things I was referring to, that adds to how easy it becomes to criticize people as being too competitive, right? It fits a narrative, a problematic narrative. Does that help? Does that get to your question?
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I know there are more questions, so let's. I want to have other folks get the floor, but thank you so much.
Sichi, Natalia, and Van had questions.
Hello, thank you so much for the talk, and it was very informative. I think I want to move a little bit apart from the racialization part of your research and ask a bit more about, you know, a more transnational or global dimension of these after-school programs or tutoring program, right? Because, you know, although there is like a hyper-education environment, admittedly in most of the upper middle class cultures in many countries, but the after-school programs, some of them are influenced by this intense culture of tutoring program, shadow education from East Asia, right? Like South Korea, China, or India. So this is one dimension of it, but I have another dimension of question I wanna ask you. But actually, and I wanna know your take on that, but actually the whole idea of how American schools select kids also influence how upper middle class parents in, you know, foreign countries, in my case, I'm more familiar with East Asian countries, how they raise their kids, you know, to be well-rounded, participate in all those sports activities, and, you know, kind of contrary, you know, example of how Asian Americans are trying to game the system, right? Like some of the Asian upper middle class parents in Asia were trying to push their kids to a more well-rounded, you know, kind of parenting style in order for their kids to have an advantage to getting into American colleges. So I wonder, you know, how you see this dimension of transnational parenting style, how they were, you know, kind of influence one another in this domain, right? Because some of the scholar has talking about this global security strategies, you know, how some Asian parents send their kids to American for summer camps, or, you know, how some of the American parents, even white American kids, send their children to East Asian countries for SAT tutoring, all these kind of things. So I want to know more about your take on this, you know, interaction.
You're highlighting a really excellent contradiction, which is that on the one hand, we're seeing, you know, this is, don't take this literally, but we're taking like seeing like the Asianification of higher education in the US, whereas a lot of programs around tutoring that are, you know, part and parcel of some, you know, certain Asian countries' educational infrastructure are now growing in the US. So, you know, if you look at tutoring trends worldwide, right, the US and Canada is seeing a huge uplift, a huge increase, but that's primarily because they've had so little of it compared to other countries in the past. Okay. So we're seeing these in the, you know, and there's a lot of evidence in New York City of a lot of white families going to ethnic cram schools to give their kids opportunities that, especially when those, these major franchises weren't as popular as they are now. And so to your first point, a lot of the trends we see around education, right, in other parts of the country, other parts of the world are growing here. I mean, Kumon is a Japanese company, for example. And junior Kumon, as I pointed out earlier, starts at age 3. In Japan, you can start at age 2. So, you know, it's still a leg up. But at the same time, we're seeing this kind of Asianification, which is, again, as soon as I use that word, I don't like it. But anyway, as soon as we're seeing this trend in hyper-education here, to your other point, right, colleges, which is kind of like the gatekeepers of this conversation, are saying, well, we don't want kids to be so singular-minded. We want them to be well-rounded, right? And so they're kind of someplace downplaying the advantages that come from hyper-education. I talked to college admissions office about this, and there really is kind of a no-win situation for a lot of the parents. The admissions officers say, you know, well, yeah, a lot of the times we will evaluate these Asian children, Asian American children, relative to other Asian Americans. And so, you know, they, their SAT scores and grades and APs and everything else, yeah, they're being compared to people who are of their same demographic, including class demographic, by the way, not just in terms of race. So, but at the same time, we don't want children who just did a lot of academics and didn't do other stuff. Well, it's kind of hard to have it both ways because there's only so many hours in the day and only so much stress a high school student can handle, right? So while we're seeing a growth in hyper-education and an assumption behind that, that getting more tutoring at a young age is helpful for your academics down the road, we're also seeing a situation where colleges are saying, we want to make sure everyone's well-rounded, you don't have a singular mindset, or at least you're not just monotone in your interests, right? Even if you have a specialization, you're not monotone or fit certain kind of profiles. And that is the contradiction, right? And, here's the answer to the contradiction. No, I'm highlighting there is a contradiction playing out right now in the kind of process to college, as we're seeing, again, this growth of hyper-education and the merit that comes with it, alongside the fact that colleges are saying, you know, we want to make sure that people are well-rounded so that we have a more diverse kind of student body. And so you'll see, for instance, college counselors, you know, your high schools, you can, for your high school student, you can pay for a private college counselor. And there are those that are geared just towards Asian Americans. And part of their branding efforts is to make your child seem less Asian. I'm not even like reading between the lines here. That's partly how they present themselves. And, you know, we'll make sure you don't fit into a standard profile, even as you're doing hyper education, because you know that that's expected in order to be academically competitive, right? So because that contradiction is there that you're pointing to, there are now branding efforts by college counselors just towards Asian American, although it could be beyond that, trying to remedy the contradiction that parents are finding themselves in. In other words, this contradiction is a great business opportunity for some. And if you look at the prices they charge, you'd be amazed. hope that gets to your, hope I, you know, I don't have an answer to the contradiction as much as like.
I know that Natalie is next, but she is no longer here. So I'll take this opportunity to bring this to an end. I have many, many questions for Pawan, but I'll save all of you. The trouble of sitting through another 15 minutes of my monotone asking, but it's really wonderful to see so many colleagues and friends from across CUNY and beyond, across the country who are here on this call with us. Many had to leave early, but thank you to all of you for staying. We are so delighted that we had a chance to engage with your work. Judging by the number of questions and comments, I think that it's fair to say that you gave us a lot to think about, and it's a very provocative argument that you made today at this talk, but also with the larger book. If you have not had a chance to read this book already, I recommend that you take a look at it. You could disagree with it, argue with it, debate it. But most importantly, I think it's wonderful for any author that you engage with these ideas and carry the conversation forward. And last but not least, I want to thank Hayden Chu for helping me with so much behind the scene work. And then my other colleague, Richard Osijo, who is the director of the International Migration Studies Program, who's no longer here on this call. We have worked together to put together this series of events, and I don't want to take all the credits. In fact, everyone else does more work than I do. So with that, thank you again, Pawan, and hopefully we can ask everyone else with other questions to write to you directly one-on-one. So please join me in thanking our speaker today.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Van, thank you, Vivian, thank you, Hayden. Thank you all for being here. It was a wonderful opportunity to share and also just engage and be among, feel very connected to the CUNY community as an adopted space. And I really value every time I have to engage. Thank you so much.
All right, till next time.